Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Monday, March 30th, welcome, 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 friends. On Into the Program, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Benjamin Franklin, you know we had to start with him.
You had to
Benjamin
start with
Franklin famously wrote, "In this world, nothing can be said to be certain except death and taxes."
Mm.
And sometimes when you do your taxes, you kind of want to die.
Yep.
The U.S. tax code is thousands of pages long, filled with ever-changing rules for deductions, credits, exceptions, subsidies, and much more. And every spring, Americans pull their hair out trying to get the numbers right.
So welcome to the latest installment of our monthly Big Fix series, where we try to solve America's most intractable problems. And today, we're taking on our tax code, and we are asking, how can we make taxes simple and equitable? Can we ensure that people pay their fair share and that the government gets what it needs to provide the services that we all rely on?
And so we've asked three tax experts with different perspectives to pitch their boldest ideas for reimagining the tax system. Along the way, we'll cover things like the flat tax, the billionaire's tax, the land value tax, and more.
And we have got a great panel with us. We have Amy Hanauer, Executive Director of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. We also have Adam Michelle, Director of Tax Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, and Daniel Garrett, Assistant Professor of Finance at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Cherry, for having us. This is wonderful.
Yes, yes, yes.
Thanks for having us on.
Happy to be here.
All right. And our question for you, our listeners, is this. What would be your big fix to our tax code? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our streamers on YouTube or Facebook, you could drop your comments in the chat.
All right. So the way this works is everyone's brought a couple of ideas with us, and we're going to go through each of these ideas in like a cycle. And we're going to start with Amy. Amy's first idea has to do with fixing corporate taxes. So, Amy, lay out the problem and the solution.
Yeah, thank you so much. We just need to make sure that corporations actually pay taxes. And unfortunately, after two rounds of Trump tax cuts, they don't. We have seen that corporate tax avoidance is as bad or worse today than it has ever been. Many corporations pay little or no taxes. My colleagues at the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy have a tax tracker on our website. We find that 280 companies avoided $137 billion in taxes in 2025, just so on their 2025 profits just so far. So, you know, you got these huge tax, these huge corporations like Tesla paying zero, but this can be fixed. We can fix it by putting in place a global minimum tax. That was something that all of the Democrats except Joe Manchin wanted and that we didn't get under Joe Biden, but that would really get rid of corporate tax avoidance. And we can fix it by getting rid of these pass-through loopholes that let huge, enormous entities that have all of the characteristics of corporations not pay the corporate tax. So make sure corporations pay. That'll be... it will increase the fairness of our tax code. It will fall mostly on very rich people, and it will raise a lot of revenue for all of the things that Americans need. Healthcare, education, these are things that are much lower cost in other countries because they raise more adequate taxes.
So, Amy, let me ask you, you said there are these loopholes that corporations exploit. Give an example of one that you think is the most costly to our tax system.
Yeah, corporations hide enormous profits overseas in tax havens like Bermuda and Barbados, and it costs us an enormous amount of money. And we had a fix to this that 165 of the largest economies in the world were ready to sign on to and did sign on to. And a bunch of our trading partners started implementing that. But we didn't get it through when Biden was president, and then Trump really undermined it. So I think the next time we have a president and Congress who are willing to fix the tax code, that should be the first thing they do, is to put in place this global minimum tax, stop corporations from hiding their profits in overseas tax havens.
So how would a global minimum tax work? Because in my mind, I'm thinking, if there's a way to move money around to avoid paying taxes, any sort of rational corporation is going to do it. When you close down one loophole, another one opens up. What is this global minimum? How would it work? How would the U.S. enforce it?
Yeah, that was what was so great about this structure, is that all of these OECD nations, all of the large wealthy economies, large wealthy democracies, agreed to do this. And the way it would work is that if other countries impose really low corporate taxes, you could make up for it in the other countries in which these corporations want to operate. So it was a really elegant structure. And it is a really elegant structure. And what is going to happen is that these other countries are going to start putting it in place, and the American people are going to lose out on the revenue, while Germans and Brazilians and Japanese families are going to see the revenue invested in their countries from avoidance that U.S. corporations are doing here, because these other trading partners are going to be able to put it in place in their countries.
Yeah. And Amy, one thing you've also said is that some large corporations use parts of the tax code that is meant for small businesses. Could you explain that, and how does that happen?
Yeah. So there are something called pass-through businesses that pose as sort of small businesses, but really, like Bechtel, these enormous Fidelity, the Trump Organization, are some examples of enormous pass-through businesses that have millions, billions in profits, but they are able to get into this part of the tax code that's meant for small businesses. And we can't even audit or really understand how they're doing it. It wasn't the way it was originally intended, but over time we expanded. So now the United States, there's only a couple of countries in the world that have more of their businesses organized as pass-through entities than the United States. So if we close this loophole and just make them pay the corporate tax, we'll be able to collect enormous amounts of revenue that can give the American people what so many other countries around the world kind of consider to be part of their basic social contract. Yeah. Free healthcare, low-cost college, free childcare.
Adam, let me ask you a couple questions building off of Amy's proposal. One, we talk about closing down loopholes. Mm-hmm. Do you think you could reasonably close down all the loopholes without creating new ones? Second, would this incentive, if you did close down the loopholes, would it incentivize corporations to disinvest or to offshore? Your thoughts on that?
These are the exact two questions that I think we should be asking. On the global minimum tax, we have three corporate minimum taxes already in the tax code. They mostly just lend additional complexity and compliance cost, and all of them have these sort of holes that ultimately are added to these systems for good reason, because if you make them too stringent, you're simply just penalizing the job creation, investment, and activity you want to happen here in the United States. Even the global minimum tax that would have been imposed by the OECD and a bunch of European countries that Amy was mentioning had a whole bunch of these holes in it, where countries could incentivize companies to move to their country with direct subsidies and refundable tax credits, and a whole bunch of other margins on which competition for lower rates
was that a problem of political will, or was it a problem of you just can't design a law that would stamp out all these little fires, in your opinion, Adam?
In the case of the OECD, this was it was political will, but I don't think we can divorce the two. You need a system that can get buy-in, and this system didn't meet that threshold. On the question of getting out of what are the economic effects of such a proposal, I think it's most important to remember that the corporation itself isn't paying the tax at the end of the day. Economists talk about tax incidents, who ultimately bears the economic cost of the tax. And this is ultimately going to be either the workers who the business employs, the consumers who purchase the things the business is selling, or the investors in the business. And there's a whole deep economic literature on which of these three factors ultimately bears the cost. And in my view, it's mostly workers. They're the thing that can't move international capital can move to other countries, businesses can move, consumer prices are ultimately set in broader markets. And so workers in the form of fewer jobs and lower wages ultimately bear the burden of these business taxes. And that's why we want to keep them as low as possible.
Daniel, your quick thoughts on that. Do you think that's who would bear the ultimate cost of any sort of increased corporate tax?
Avi, that is a huge question. So as one of those academic economists who has contributed a little bit to this literature on where the incidence of the corporate tax falls. So if we raise a dollar of corporate taxes, who winds up paying that? So it can show up in higher prices, it can show up in reduced investment and reduced jobs, that sort of thing. I think it's important to remember the context a little bit of what has happened with corporate tax rates around the world since the early 1980s. Corporate tax rates have had what is called, what's often referred to as a global race to the bottom, as people have kind of lowered tax rates from in the realm of 40% today in the realm of 20% and maybe a little bit below. What that tax competition does is it says capital is going to move to the lower tax place, and that that capital movement can also impact workers and whatnot. So I think one of the things that is maybe not quite appreciated in this context and the discussion so far, which Amy and Adam have done a great job covering, is that the global minimum tax is about changing the outside option for the capital in the US and saying you can't necessarily move to, I'm going to name a country that is sometimes thought of as a tax haven, say Ireland.
Right. And you're setting a floor.
Yeah, you're setting a floor. And so that floor is going to say everyone can raise at least this much revenue off capital income. That rate, of course, was going to be relatively lower still than labor or wage rates in the US. But the idea is about this international substitution and how important is this for the other agents in the economy as well, particularly the workers. I can talk more, but
thank you so much.
And by the way, I want to bring in a caller because our question of the day to our listeners is, what would be your big fix to our tax code? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And Beth from Cheltenham has a big idea. Beth, you're on Studio 2. What's your big fix? I think we don't have Beth.
That'll fix it.
That's all right. So we're going to move on to Adam Michelle's big fix. Your big idea for this first round is a national flat tax consumption tax, a flat rate consumption tax. Lay it out. What is the problem you seek to fix and lay out your solution?
Yeah, so this is a sort of rip it all out from its roots and start over proposal, and it would fix, in my view, the major problems we currently face. Our tax code is overly complicated, as you laid out excellently in the beginning. It has too many credits, deductions, carve-outs, which ultimately treat similarly situated people differently. It adds about $500 billion of annual compliance cost, and then the system is also economically distortionary. It layers multiple layers of tax on savings and investment and ultimately encourages people to consume more today and save less for the future than they would without a distortionary tax system. And so if we take out the entire federal tax code and replace it with a single rate, low flat tax on ultimate final consumption through a wage tax and a business tax that allows full deductions for wages paid and investment, you get to this consumption tax base, which is one of the least distortionary ways to raise revenue in a way that is fair, treating similarly situated people similarly, and has this tremendous economic benefit where it's not discouraging investment, which is the lifeblood of long-run economic growth and wage gain.
Yeah, and could you just give us an example? So give us an example. Use $100. Somebody get paid $100 and explain how this would change for a normal person.
Yeah, so you earn your wage, you earn $100. Each American would receive an exemption, and effectively a 0% tax rate on some initial piece of your income. The current standard deduction is a good way of thinking about that. Mm-hmm. It could probably be higher. And then you pay one flat rate on everything you earn over that. No need to think about additional itemized deductions or tax credits or all the complexity that comes with those systems. And then businesses would face one simple system that mirrors that at the same tax rate, allowing full deductions for wages paid and investments made. And that gets you to that non-distortionary consumption tax base.
Now in this scenario, the poorest person pays 5%, the richest person pays 5%, or whatever the number is, right?
Correct.
How do you adjust
for? Yeah.
Is that
for a living standard or for
right.
For sort of what
above
your
a certain amount above
are.
A certain correct. Amount. Yeah. So how would you sort of just some a lot of people would have a problem with that just on an sort of an equity mm-hmm. perspective. There's people that have way more money than they'd ever need to meet all their basic needs. Shouldn't they pay more? Now I think you're arguing that there is something distortionary about that, that it disincentivizes people from building wealth. Is that the idea, or like how would you defend what might feel very unequal or unfair to folks on the surface?
Yeah, so I think it's the fairest system. It's treating everyone the same. It's saying if the tax rate is 20%, everyone is paying 20%. Whether I earn $100 or $1 billion, I'm paying the same 20% of what I earn. And that is, I think, treating that is true equity. That's treating everyone similarly. And states have many states at the state level have moved towards this flat rate system because it's getting rid of the complexity and treating everyone the same, so you can't game it. There's also the economic benefit. The as you have higher marginal tax rates, if you increase tax rates, the more you earn, you're creating disincentives not just to start new businesses, but also to invest in more years of education and to work longer hours, to put in the type of effort that moves you up those income brackets. And we see this across countries. Often, people think that European countries, that people take longer vacations there simply because they like taking more vacation, or there's some difference in work ethic. Much of that difference can be explained in wage tax rates. When the government takes a larger share of your next dollar earned, you have a smaller incentive to earn that next dollar. And so if you can bring rates down and treat everyone similarly, you are also encouraging additional work, which is necessary for sort of long run production and economic prosperity.
So Amy, let's get mm-hmm. your reaction to this. Simplifying sounds good. I don't want to spend hours and hours trying to figure out how much I owe the government. Do you think this simplification would be worth the trade-offs in terms of taking the tax rate and saying it's not going to be progressive, it's going to be flat? Excuse me, your thoughts, Amy.
Yeah, the reason that our tax code is complicated is because wealthy people and corporations have demanded tons and tons of exemptions. And what Adam is suggesting would in two ways make sure that regular working people pay more of their income in taxes and that the very wealthiest and corporations pay less of their income in taxes. So it really makes no sense whatsoever. So he's saying that in two ways. One, he wants a flat rate so that you wouldn't pay a higher rate when you earn more. You know, I think we need to ask ourselves when we look at whether a tax is fair, is it your billionth dollar or is it your 10,000th dollar? And I think that we all would agree that those of us who earn a lot more money, especially from wealth and not from working, should be they're getting more out of our system and they should pay more into it. And then the other thing that he's doing is shifting taxes from earnings to consumption, or from income to consumption. That also is a way of making sure that lower income people who have to spend most of what they earn have to pay a higher rate. So in all kinds of ways, he's basically suggesting a tax code that would demand far less from those most able to pay and would demand more from the average American. I think it's a huge mistake.
Yeah. How would this?
I would like to just add one.
But how would this help? How would this help the person sort of, or how would this someone who's making very little, who does need to spend a lot of their income just to meet their basic needs? How do you think this system would help them, Adam? Because I could see how it would hurt them in terms of the percentage of what they make going toward taxes. But what's the benefit for them?
The benefit is up to a living standard, your income is exempt. So you don't pay income tax on sort of basic living necessities. And Amy said that the tax code is incredibly complicated because corporations and billionaires have asked for these carve-outs. That is 100% correct. But it's not just at the top end of the income distribution. It's also at the bottom end, whether it's that we have something like six different definitions of child in the tax code for the child tax credit and the earned income tax credit. All of these programs are incredibly complicated and make tax paying arduous for people, not just at the top, but also at the bottom. So the simplification of the system also benefits people at every single level. And that's the being able to do your taxes on a postcard is a benefit mostly for people whose time is scarce, who are taking that second job, who don't want to figure out how to do it on TurboTax. So it's not just an exemption for lower income people for living standards, yep. but also simplification for everyone.
And we're going to put a pin in that. And we'll be right back, Adam. We're talking about taxes today. And our question of the day is, what would be your big fix to our tax code? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. And by the way, Daniel, we'll give you a chance on the other side of the break to respond. We'll be right back. This is Studio 2.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. It is our monthly Big Fix episode where we debate solutions to some of the tough problems facing America. Today, we are looking at our complicated, inefficient, and many would argue inequitable tax system.
We asked our three guests to each bring two ideas to the table for improving the tax code and have been talking through their solutions this hour. Let me reintroduce our guests. Amy Hanauer is Executive Director of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. Adam Michel is Director of Tax Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. And Daniel Garrett is Assistant Professor of Finance at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Daniel Garrett, you've been listening here, sitting here patiently.
Yes.
First, your thoughts on this flat tax idea. It seemed like you were very excited by the conversation we're having, so go ahead.
I am. I think this is a really interesting and exciting idea. Mm-hmm. So again, I think when we think about what makes a tax distortionary, it's that it makes you change the behavior that you're doing. So an income tax makes you maybe produce less income.
Yep.
And then, of course, an income tax also is going to tax both that income that you're putting into savings, that income you're putting into consumption. So this old idea that is, look, let's tax consumption instead so this doesn't distort the savings decision. So we get people still invest in their local businesses or invest in more education, that sort of thing. There is a cool idea that has sometimes been floated called the X tax, which is very, very similar to this, where essentially you can see how much someone's consuming based on basically taking their wage income or a business taking what their cash flows are. And then, of course, you kind of know, well, everything that they didn't save is going to be consumed.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can do everything you do with an income tax with one of these consumption taxes. So you can make these taxes progressive. There's no reason it really needs to be a flat tax. So we start thinking about equity. Equity to me is everyone is going to face the same schedule. But if you maybe are making less money, you may be able to pay a lower marginal tax rate. And if you're making more money, you may pay a higher marginal tax rate. But there's no reason these things really have to be flat. And so I wanted to make just one quick comment about another idea that sometimes it is rhetorically, it makes sense to say, we think that a tax that is more broad is going to be easier. It's going to be less distortive because it covers more things,
mm-hmm.
right? So instead of taxing one thing a lot, we're going to tax two things a little bit less. And then hopefully this is going to be less distortionary. That's not necessarily always true. There was a famous economist named Ramsey who came up with a thing called the Ramsey Rule that basically said you really want the most efficient tax to be on things that change behavior less. Mm-hmm. And so if there are different parts of consumption that might actually be more and less responsive to a tax, you actually may not want to have a flat tax at all. And you could imagine if people's labor decisions or consumption decisions are different across the income distribution, you could make a very strong argument for, I think, a progressive tax rate on one of these consumption taxes.
All right, now let's get into your first big idea, Daniel. So it's funny that we're talking to you here in Philadelphia because when I go home most days, I drive by a plaque for the childhood home of a guy who was a big champion of this idea of a land value tax, native Philadelphian. So what is a land value tax? And how's it going to help us?
That's a great question. I'm going to answer your question, but let me also say when you all talked about this session, you said big ideas.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I wanted to think of something really, really outside of the box that, of course, people might have heard of, but has never really been tried, and especially not tried on a national level in the U.S., or really, I think, thought about seriously, at least in the last century or so. A land value tax is a levy on the value of land without regard to any buildings, improvements, or personal property that are also on the land.
So it's, so you tax it the same regardless of whether it's a skyscraper or an empty lot.
The idea is you're taxing the land, mm-hmm. pretending that whatever's on it isn't actually there. So you're thinking about taxing just the rental value of using this land, regardless of any improvement. The idea being that most of the value of land is what Henry George famously called an unearned increment. Mm-hmm. So that is to say, the value of living in a place or having a property in a place is mostly a function of what are the other characteristics of that place? Who else lives there? Are the schools really good?
Good roads.
Are there plentiful jobs?
All the things that deal with infrastructure that we all pay for.
All that infrastructure that we pay for when we're paying for school bonds or when we are paying for new water treatment plant facilities, like those sorts of things, that drives the value of property. And so that's not necessarily driven by the incentives of the landowner themselves. Mm-hmm. So the idea is most of that value is driven by the decisions and the prosperity of the community. And that value should go back to the rest of the community through a tax that would then allow it to be spent on things that kind of increase the well-being of people who live there.
So the problem now that you're trying to solve, let me see if I understand this, is that right now, if I build something on a piece of land, something good, I'm kind of penalized for it in a way because my property taxes go up. Is that the idea? And you would say, let's get rid of that disincentive.
So I'm thinking of two things here. One of which is on the incentives, exactly as you say. Right now, if we have a property tax, where property taxes are almost entirely levied by state and local entities right now, that's kind of the way it's been. And there's some legal context there that is probably worth thinking about more. But the incentive structure is not the only thing. I think there is a lot of revenue that could be raised because there are the implicit rents on land in the U.S. are a substantial portion of income. And they are progressively rated. That is, rich people own more land and own more property than poor people. It's, of course, not perfectly correlated with income. There are lots and lots of problems, particularly elders who are aging and aging in place and that sort of thing.
Gentrification concerns,
really big concerns. But I was thinking, As a source of revenue, this is a source of revenue that is largely untapped and also happens to have incentives where it would move incentives away from saying, I want to speculate on land in case my neighbors do something great and the value goes up. And it would say, well, if I have this land, now I want to do something great that's not going to raise my property tax at all, but might actually make my neighbors better off.
And you can't move land. You can't hide land. You can't move land overseas.
So that's the real cool thing. So the land value tax, famously, of course, pushed by Henry George, also is one of those rare places where economists will basically all agree. I'll name three Nobel Prize winners. So Joseph Stiglitz, Milton Friedman, and Paul Krugman, who are very, very different people in very different parts of the political spectrum, all agree that a land value tax is not very distortionary relative to basically every other tax out there. The idea is land is in fixed supply. We can kind of build more fake land outside of on the sea, but it's not really in the conversation yet. Most land is fixed. So if you tax it, it can't get up and walk away. So when we start thinking about so this is actually back to Adam's earlier comment on our income taxes and fixing the corporate tax. Capital can move. Labor can move a little bit. Mm-hmm. Land really can't move at all. And so you might say someone different might use the land. And is particularly the tax burden would be highest on people who currently own vacant land. That's where kind of I think a lot of this would fall. And of course, that has kind of interesting incentives.
Yeah. And I was wondering, like, what would you say to someone who is they have land, but they don't have a lot of cash? How do you make the argument to them?
Yeah, making the argument to someone who has land and who has a lot of land and not a lot of cash. So they are land rich and cash
poor.
Maybe
they inherited, land, but they don't have, they're not rich, they're not a rich person.
Yeah. So I think there are lots of solutions to these sorts of problems. Mm-hmm. The easiest solutions are ones of deferral. That is to say, much like we have with capital gains taxes today, if you have, say, a really expensive financial asset that has increased in a lot of value and you're going to sell it, you don't have to pay tax on that until you actually realize the sale. Mm. You could defer land value taxes in a similar way. I don't think now I think that could be extremely politically unpopular, and maybe I'll inspire a caller to tell me how much how wrong I am and how hurtful that would be. But there are ways around that, and I think I would put forward deferral as my preferred way.
Patricia agrees. Land value tax would be very helpful. Someone who's on your team there. Let's bring another caller. This is Dan from Ardmore. Dan, you're going to be the first caller that actually makes it onto the air today,
Dan.
We believe. Dan, go ahead.
That's great. Thank you. Well, one of your guests actually mentioned something that's really core to my question. You mentioned that capital can move. And I've always been under the understanding that the movement of money around an economy is what makes it healthy. And when money stagnates, that's an unhealthy economy. So wouldn't that then be the argument to tax those that have more of a progressive tax? If all of the wealth stagnates at the top of the economy, wouldn't that inherently make the economy unhealthy?
Interesting. Okay, let me, Daniel, you're our academic here. Take on that question.
Yeah.
From another Dan.
Dan from Ardmore, that is a really, really good question. So when I talk about capital movement, it's easiest to think about this in a few different ways. I'm thinking that wealth is always going to be so I have my progress and poverty here.
Yeah.
Henry George defines wealth as the capital that you've set aside to generate more income.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is any wealth that is applied to, say, if you invest in a local business or you buy a S&P 500 ETF. That is you investing capital, you giving your capital to someone, and they're going to do stuff with it. Mm-hmm. So is that stagnant? I don't think that's necessarily stagnant to say if it's the same person putting more and more money into the S&P. That is money moving around. The S&P is, of course, 500 firms doing all sorts of different things around the world. Paper mills and building, making steel and building all sorts of things that we use in our lives. But so the idea about this capital movement is one of, if the U.S. taxes capital relatively more, what investors will do is they'll look offshore for investment opportunities that will have higher after-tax returns. And so it's not necessarily saying we don't want capital to be moving around through the economy, that people are buying and spending and people are transacting and investing in businesses and building things. It's that we want them to be doing it in the U.S. And we still want to be able to take all of that activity and take small increments of that activity and allocate it toward the public use.
Yeah. By the way, I wanted to get Adam and Amy's thoughts on the land value tax. Your thoughts on this, Amy? Any thoughts?
Yeah, I have no argument with the land value tax. I think that there are lots of different reforms that we can make to local property taxes that would raise more revenue and allow us to tax property more efficiently and have sort of better urban planning. I just want to say something about Dan from Ardmore. I mean, that's a great question, right? Is inequality good for the economy? Inequality is really bad for the economy because it means that a small number of people are hoarding more of the resources and we have less to invest in, like, tomorrow's Benjamin Franklin, right? Like, if we're not able to invest in our schools, in our healthcare, in our in making college affordable, then the economy is not as efficient as it should be, because it means that we're not able to get the most out of all of our people. And we have an economy that has grown much more unequal, and it's very inefficient. So I think Dan from Ardmore really made a great point in his column.
Yeah, any thoughts from you, Adam?
On this inequality point, most measures of inequality are static measures. And I think what's most interesting is looking at generational mobility and the ability to make more out of your life. If you look at something like the list of the Forbes 400 richest people in the country, there's like 5% of that list is the same as it was in the 1980s, which tells you the United States is an incredibly dynamic place. And so we want to be looking at over time, how are people becoming better off? And so most of the proposals to increase taxes on the high end, tax capital income or wealth, are really about just knocking people down a peg from the top. And I think we should be thinking about solutions that are really helping everyone become wealthier over time. And so that in that sense, we want taxes that are like that have features of this land value tax that we've been discussing, taxes that are non-distortionary, that are not hitting wages or investment, that are easy to move and do create these big distortions. So in that sense, I do think that the land value tax is a great example of the types of taxes we should be talking about, rather than ones that are hitting things that are easily manipulatable, that are easy to manipulate, like business income and wages, especially at the top end of the distribution.
Okay, well, we're coming up on another break, but it sounds like there's some interesting intellectual sort of mesh point happening here on the land value tax. So perhaps something to pick up another day. Let me read a couple more comments. David Bagan on YouTube says, we all pay a flat tax at Target for merchandise. Why can't we also pay a flat income tax? Maura Lacates on YouTube says, a big help would be to tax religious entities, churches, etc. are tax exempt and they don't need to be. Okay, so we have a few more ideas to run through very quickly on the other side of this break. We'd love to hear from you about your big fixes to the American tax code. Studio2@WHYY.org, 888-477-9499 is the number. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
And welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Today, with tax season in full swing, we've been talking about why our tax system is so burdensome, overly complicated, and inefficient. It's our Big Fix Hour, and we have three guests with us proposing possible solutions. Let me reintroduce them. Amy Hanauer is Executive Director of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. Adam Michel is Director of Tax Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. And Daniel Garrett is Assistant Professor of Finance at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania.
Yes, and for our listeners at home, on the road, or elsewhere, we want your ideas too. Our question is, what would be your big fix to our tax code? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And our YouTube and Facebook streamers, you can drop a comment in the chat. And so we're going to move on to round two of the ideas from our panel here. Amy Hanauer, your second big fix idea is to tax income from wealth the same way we tax income from work. Break it all down for us. What is the problem and your solution?
Yeah. So, I mean, the main wealth of regular people is in their homes, and we do tax homes through property taxes every year, as Dan was talking about earlier. But we don't tax the main sources of wealth that higher income people have. And we have a huge bunch of tax breaks around capital gains income. So first is that we don't tax the wealth. We only tax the income from that wealth. So we only tax it at the point of sale. And second is that even at that point, we tax it at a much lower rate than we tax income from work. So the top capital gains tax rate is 20%, whereas the top earned income tax rate is 37%. So we want to, and then what happens is that people are able to pass on their assets without ever paying any taxes on them. They can pass them on to their heirs, and their heirs inherit them at the new value, and nobody ever pays any taxes on the growth in income on that wealth. And that's how people like Bezos are able to just gobble up a larger and larger and larger shares of the economy.
And then so here's a comment from Chris in Allentown. Please discuss how the ultra rich avoid paying taxes by borrowing against their assets. Because the obvious sort of, I guess, critique of that, what you laid out there, Amy, is that, well, you can let money accrue value in the market, but you at some point have to take it out to use it. And then you pay the tax on it. I think what Chris is saying, what I imagine you're going to say, is that there's a way around that.
Yeah, you would think, right? You would think. But the fact is that very wealthy people like Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos can borrow against the value of their assets, and they can purchase anything that they want with that borrowing. And then they never pay taxes on it until they pass it on to their heirs. And their heirs don't pay taxes on it either, because the heirs inherited at the new value. So it just makes a lot of sense to close these loopholes. They are not available to regular people. They are available mostly to the uber wealthy. And it distorts our economy and leaves us with the incredible inequality that we have, that not only means that a small number of people are gobbling up more and more resources, but it also means that they are like controlling our democracy. They're controlling our main sources of information. And it just is very, very distortionary.
And we only have we have to move pretty quickly through this. So I want to give Adam about 30 seconds to critique Amy's big idea.
Well, I think we do want to treat all sources of income similarly. And that's why I originally proposed a consumption tax, so that we tax the people when they actually end consume the income, whether it comes from wealth or from wages. But what Amy is proposing really just increases taxes on savings and investment for ultra wealthy people and average Americans. And this will have dramatic impacts, meaning that we have less investment in businesses and new tools and the innovation that we need to stay ahead in our modern economy.
So you're saying it would disincentivize people from putting money in the stock market, essentially, and then through that method, investing in companies. And I believe your second idea, Adam, is to create an incentive for people to invest and save their income. So let's lead right into that.
Yes. Yeah, you're exactly right. And wealth is not just gold bars in the back of someone's closet. Wealth is in ongoing businesses, in lots of closely held businesses, in Amazon, in SpaceX. And if you tax that stock of wealth, you're actively taking a bite out of these companies that employ millions of Americans. The way that most Americans invest in the stock market, in companies across the country, are through things like their 401k, their IRA, their 529 plans for education. And so my second big idea is simplifying this system. We have over a dozen of these tax-preferred accounts that basically just remove capital gains and dividends taxes on investments, and instead allow people to put their savings in what's called a universal savings account. It wipes away all the complexity where you have to choose if you're saving for retirement or for health or for education, and instead says, we're going to get the government out of that decision and just allow you to save for whatever your life's priorities are. And so it's a simpler system, allowing more Americans access to something that is mostly just used by wealthy people today because of the complexity and because of the requirement that you have to lock your savings up for a specific purpose. These accounts have been tried in the UK and in Canada, and they're incredibly popular. They're actually more used by lower income and younger people because of this flexibility. And so I think it's an incremental step in the right direction, both simplifying the tax code and removing some of this distortion where we double and triple tax savings and investment.
Yeah. So, Amy, is this not a good idea for trying to get people to save more? Say you can put it in an account. It doesn't have to be for retirement. It doesn't have to be for college. You're putting it in an account. It can grow. And you're incentivized to invest in our economy and to save money. What would be the downside?
Yeah. I mean, I think that what we really want to focus on in our tax code is how can we have more of the enormous wealth that's being captured by the 1%? How can we have that more broadly shared among all of us so that we have it to invest in healthcare, in education, in college affordability? And the fact is that the way that the U.S. economy works, and the way that our tax code works, is that we reward corporate wealth, we reward individual wealth, and we reward super, super high incomes. And that just detracts from our ability to have an economy that works for all of us. So, you know, I'm for people having vehicles to save, but most of those vehicles have been really only usable by those with a lot of disposable income. And what's increasingly happening in the United States is that most people don't have a lot of disposable income, and the uber rich are consuming more and more and more of our income. So I think what makes more sense is tax corporations, 70% of Americans agree with that, tax income from wealth. Both of those things are, both of those breaks for corporate income and for wealth go overwhelmingly to the top 1%, and instead have tax code that works for all of us.
Yeah, by the way, James from Chester County says, one thing I would love to see is corporations that abuse the safety net to supplement employee income blocked from any sort of tax break. And Daniel, did you have any critique for Adam's idea?
Yeah, so I mean, I just wanted to comment quickly on So Adam's idea on savings accounts, I think, is broadly a very good idea. I don't think it's going to raise revenue. Mm-hmm. And so when we're thinking about, I wanted to just put our conversation in the context a little bit of the current deficits ongoing. Mm-hmm. So last year in 2025, the U.S. had a $1.8 trillion deficit, which of course, that's trillion with a T, is a very, very large amount of money. That's relative to kind of the total spending was about $7 trillion. So we only raised $5.2 trillion. I just wanted to say, there are already taxes in what we're doing, and these are implicit taxes on the future. That is to say, if we're spending money now that we do not have and borrowing it, we, of course, there are some interesting arguments here in monetary economics about exactly how we will pay it back in the future. But it's almost certainly going to happen through some set of taxes that we have today. And so I am going to, like, I think it's important to focus on what can actually really raise revenue if we're going to really think about structuring the tax code differently.
Before we get to your last idea, I do want to bring in Mark from DC, who I think we tried to get on earlier, then it dropped. So Mark, second time, we're going to say, is the charm.
Yes.
Mark, you're on Studio 2.
Thanks so much for taking my call. I just was going to point out, it feels like much of the focus has been on the cost of taxes and not what taxes actually benefit. And it strikes me that the beneficiaries of our tax system, namely the things that we buy with our taxes, the safety, the legal system, the military, and all these things, the biggest beneficiaries of those are the wealthiest. The wealthiest corporations succeed in part because we have this stable economy and this stable infrastructure. And it seems like what Adam and the Cato Institute in general seem to miss is who actually benefits from our system and who benefits the most. And frankly, when we look at the economy, the biggest beneficiaries are the wealthiest. And that, to me, is an argument for a more progressive tax system.
Thanks, Mark. Real quick, Daniel from University City. Keep it brief, but we'd love to bring you onto the show because this hour is about people named Daniel. Daniel, go ahead.
A lot of Daniels.
So many Dans and Daniels. Thank you for having me. I think about how I, as a Philadelphian, would prefer to take SEPTA and go to public parks over pay for private things all the time. But I am willing to pay extra for these things so that other people do not have to pay for them or have to pay less. I would gladly pay $4 per SEPTA ride instead of $2.90, which is the current rate, because I don't like driving on Philadelphia streets. I would gladly pay extra to make potholes go away. I wish there were more ways to, like, easily and dynamically participate in the tax system and have it be a source of civic pride rather than an annual complicated obligation.
Wow. Thank you. That's Daniel from University City who says he's happy to pay more taxes, right?
I like that. Didn't see that coming.
I love that. And so, Daniel Garrett, you're going to be presenting our final idea for our Big Fix series here. You're talking about carbon taxes.
I am.
Lay it all out for us.
So carbon taxes. A carbon tax is just a per ton fee on CO2 emitted. It's usually going to be paid by upstream producers of fossil fuels, not consumers directly. But of course, this does two things. So this is a distortionary tax.
It aspires to be distortionary.
Yeah. So I'll say my two big ideas, obviously, I chose here because in the context, we usually think of them as fixing some behavior. I want to highlight they can also raise revenue. Mm-hmm. So a carbon tax, of course, is the idea is we will get slightly less carbon over time. Yep. It will incentivize investments in other non-carbon-based energy sources and other non-carbon-based manufacturing in general. And of course, it'll raise a lot of revenue. Now, I will say the numbers that the U.S. has been thinking about so far for carbon taxes are quite low. So the numbers, just to give you the ranges, people often think about this kind of $25 per ton is what the Treasury has been forecasting is what our carbon tax could be. You should note the Swedish carbon tax right now is closer to $138 per ton. So you can make these things quite large. At the $25 level, it doesn't raise that much money for the U.S. It would raise more like $80 billion a year. But this is a thing that we could expand. And I think, the real benefit here is we can tax and distort some behavior when that behavior is damaging to other people.
Right. But there would be, by design, some short-term pain. So if you're a firm that produces a lot of carbon and you're hit with a big tax, you might shrink your labor force, you might automate more. Like there would be, and that would be the intention of this.
That would be the intention, yes. So the U.S. economy is large and it is vibrant with people moving across sectors all the time. Yes, the carbon tax would hurt in the short run. And this is kind of where we think, if you think that people will often think about cap and trade or the carbon tax as kind of having the same economic effects, but not the same revenue effects for the government. So, of course, if you have to actually pay a tax, you have to give up other things you were doing. You may have to shrink what sort of, let's say, oil and gas exploration you were doing. Or you may have to, say, try to be more efficient with the way in which you're running your refineries and maybe laying off people. That is absolutely partly a what we'll call a fiscal externality. Mm-hmm. But it would be part of the point, and it would also raise revenue that we could spend on other things. I think those externalities are easy to solve.
I bring in now a quote from economist from Harvard, N. Gregory Mankiw, who says, a good rule of thumb is that when you tax something, you get less of it. And that's exactly what you're aspiring to do with the carbon tax. Real quick thoughts, Amy, on a carbon tax as we get ready to close out the hour.
Yeah, I mean, look, our planet is boiling over, so anything that we can do to reduce the emissions, global greenhouse gas emissions, I think is a good idea. I have slightly other ways that I might structure it, but I am for making sure that we kind of reduce our contributions to global warming, so yeah. I applaud that suggestion.
And we only have about 30 seconds left. Adam, your thoughts?
Yeah, the key question here is, what is that externality? What are we trying to price in so that the distortion that the tax is creating is actually meeting the problem you're trying to solve? And the government, since the Obama administration, has said that cost is anywhere between $3 and almost $200. And so it's just the problem is not well defined enough to levy a tax on something that is so essential to such a large portion of the American economy. So I'd rather raise revenue other ways.
Well, your guys' insights were essential to our conversation today. Let me thank all of you. Adam Michel, Director of Tax Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, Amy Hanauer, Executive Director of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, and Daniel Garrett, Assistant Professor of Finance at the Wharton School right here at the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you all for your insights today on Studio 2.
Thank you so much, Avi and Cherry.
Yes.
Thanks for having us on.
Yes, and thank you. Yes, and thank you, of course, to our callers, the ones who got through and the ones who didn't. We appreciate you, and we hope you try again.
We love all of you.
Yes, and of course, thanks to our producers, Debbie Bilder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel Mae Bryan. Mike Schiffler and Al Banks engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory from Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We'll talk to you tomorrow.